Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome. Come on in. Pull up a stool and let me pour you a drink. And let's talk a little noir at the bar.
Thanks for joining us today for another episode of Noir at the Bar, where you get to hear some of your favorite authors reading from their books.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
And short stories. Now this season, our guest readers are authors that are going to be attending the Left Coast Crime in Seattle, April 11th to 14th. So not only do you get to hear them on the show here, you can go visit them, meet them, and maybe get a book signed.
Well, John, at my end of the bar, I am sipping a delicious tropical drink with the award-winning author Mary Kalii-Koa, who will be reading from Deadly Tides, Misty Pines Mystery. That came out last October, if I'm correct.
Thank you so much. Yes.
Take it away, Mary.
All right. Abby Kalii-Koa rolled through town in her Prius, searching the empty streets and worrying her bottom lip with her teeth. Stonebridge Assisted Living Center had called an hour ago to let her know her mother, Dora Michaels, had walked away again. It was early January on the Oregon coast. There had been no substantial rainfall for several days. The chilly mist-filled winds had come through that morning, though, and the center couldn't say exactly when her mother had slipped out their door. Time to put a better lock on that thing. Mom might not be drenched to the bone, but she'd be cold. Thankfully, this was Abby's scheduled day off. Not that the FBI didn't work with her regardless. After her daughter, Lulu, died of leukemia, they brought her back to the team as if she'd never left. They understood her bad days, same since her divorce. Despite what Jack thought about how she'd handled her grief, burying herself in her work and having the support of the Bureau had saved her more than once, especially the flex schedule. With her mother's early onset of Alzheimer's, it allowed for these occasional searches. or not so occasional, as it were. Mom had escaped three times this month. Greenery and garland from the holidays had clung to the street lamps on Misty Pine's main strip, but she had yet to catch a glimmer of her mother's fiery red hair. At a crawl, Abby glanced inside each of the storefronts. Last time she'd found her mother at the donut counter picking out an apple fritter. Honey's favorite, she'd repeated all the way to the car, her hand gripping a white bag full of them. Abby's Hawaiian father, Honey, as her mother had called him, had treated the family to fritters every Saturday morning since Abby could remember. He died 20 years ago, but Abby had continued the tradition with her own family until Lulu died, and it became too painful. Today, the donut shop seats and bar stools were empty. On Shoals Ferry Road, kids played on the swings and monkey bars of the elementary school. The time before the donut shop, Abby had found Mom by the cyclone fence, her fingers clenching the metal lattice, watching the kindergarten class play kickball. They both cried as Abby drove her back to the facility. Alzheimer's had been brutal to her mother, stealing much of her mind, but memories of Lulu were ingrained, even deeper than those of Abby. Dora often gazed at her like they'd never met. Abby pulled in front of the bookstore, ignoring the pain in her chest. Emily Kruger greeted her from behind the counter, sorting a new shipment of novels with bare-chested men and women in flowing gowns on their covers. Abby explained the situation. "I haven't seen your mom, but I'll call if I do." Emily reached a hand across the counter and squeezed Abby's forearm. Emily had endured the disappearance of her own daughter a few months ago. If anyone understood Abby's concern, Emily did. "Thank you. I'm sure she's just out picking flowers or..." Or what? Where did a 64-year-old woman wander to? What was she looking for when she left the warm confines of the assisted living home into the cool and murky outdoors? "Maybe she's folding laundry," Emily suggested. Abby chuckled despite her worry. During the summer, Dora had strolled into the laundromat down the road to fold a stranger's tidy-whities. But that's also why fear prickled Abby's spine now. Dora stuck to the downtown area when she walked off. Why not this time? Abby slid back into her car and dialed Trudy at the sheriff's station. "No reports about your mom have come in today. You'll call if one does?" "Certainly, hun, and I'll let Jax know." "Jax." Abby stretched her neck. "Don't bother him. If needed, I'll call him later." "Oh, I thought you two had decided to work on your relationship. We've been so busy and..." Abby trailed off. She didn't have a good reason for why things hadn't progressed between them, only that she was to blame. "It'll work itself out," Trudy said. "You've both been through a lot." Abby gnawed on her thumbnail. "Yeah, you're right. Have you checked the ocean parks? Next on my list." Abby accelerated out of town, tension growing in her shoulders. It shouldn't be so easy for residents to walk out of an assisted living center. In truth, she was more annoyed with herself that Dora had to be there in the first place. But Abby had to work and couldn't give her mom the full-time care she needed. Better facilities could be found in Portland, those focused on memory diseases, but they were a couple-hour drive. At least when her mom walked off from Stonebridge, she couldn't get far. And Abby was close enough to hop in her car to search. She'd been in law enforcement long enough to know those 30 to 60 minutes could make all the difference, a fact she was being reminded of today and another source of frustration. Abby hadn't caught the call on her phone when the staff at Stonebridge first reached out this morning. It took three attempts. She'd been in the shower shaving her legs, of all things, as if anyone would notice. Abby turned into the boat basin. She cruised through the parking lot, noting the fishing boats rocking dockside. She scanned each of them, spotting a crew of fishermen ready to brave the bar, but no redheads traversed the area. Next, she headed out Ocean Drive, turning onto Metal Road a couple of miles later. The route led to the ocean and was miles from the facility. Too far for Dora to wander? She'd been gone half a day now. If motivated, she could have made it this far. Abby's hands tightened on the wheel. Thick mist had rolled in and hung in the sky. The temperature had dipped. She swung her car into the abandoned beach parking lot and got out. Wind whistled past her as she pressed to the top of the lot and scanned the shore. The sand blasted against her pant legs with hollow pops and stung her face. She lowered the sunglasses from the top of her head onto her eyes and wrapped her jacket tighter as the cool air bit through the thin fabric. "Where are you, Mom?" Seagulls squawked overhead, catching the drafts. A few landed near the surf, arguing over an empty styrofoam container. Aside from birds, though, the beach was empty. Only rocks stood sentinel offshore, water eddying around them. This was too far south of one of the surfing beaches and too far north of the other. No place to crab or fish here either. Summer had long passed for tourists to visit, except for the random one or two that had lost their way and stumbled upon the place. The local morning beachcombers had already come and gone, likely sipping coffee in front of a warm fire by now. Abby's focus drifted to the tree-lined cliffs in the distance. Some trees had fallen catapult and hapless onto the dunes. Others had come in on the tide. Abby scanned the area of the signs for the signs of her mother. That's when she saw the splash of red rising from a row of logs near the sandy ridge. Whatever was there had hunkered down. Hiding? Mom. Abby raced down the hill, the soft white sand sucking at her practical flats. She gave up and kicked them aside. 50 yards farther, she hit the hard pack and sprinted, the wind at her back. As she drew closer, another flash of red provided certainty that it was hair flapping in the wind. "Mom, is that you?" Abby hollered. She slowed her pace to a walk as she approached. The woman was dressed in a nightgown and hunched like a turtle with only her back showing, shaking. Her red hair, streaked in gray, whipped upward. My God, she was whimpering. Abby's heart pounded. Her mother must be freezing. She almost ran again, but it was almost always best to approach Dora in the same manner she'd approach a small child. "Mom," she said again. Still no response. If she was deep in her illness, the word might not register. "Dora." Her mother lifted her head. "It's mine." Abby blew out a long, weary sigh. She'd found Dora, alive and talking. That's what mattered. Slipping out of her jacket, Abby draped it over her mom before sitting on the log next to her. "You sure came a long way." Abby gazed out at the water. Relief at finding her mother unharmed whooshed through her like the breeze around them. Her heartbeat found its steady rhythm. "How about we get someplace warm and dry? Pancakes sound good, don't they? Let's find some hot pancakes and drench them in real maple syrup. You'd love that, right, Mom?" "Okay, but I want to take it with me. I found it." Her mother had probably discovered some unique shell or glass fishing float. Whatever she'd found, she could keep. Abby would help her display it in her room. "Sure, Mom." Dora straightened, and Abby's stomach twisted at the sight of the blood saturating the front of her mother's white gown. "Are you okay?" Abby said, her voice inching up. Then she saw the source of the blood. In her hands, her mother held a tennis shoe containing a severed foot.
Well, that is engaging and well-written, and you're telling a story there that actually I personally connect with because my father had Alzheimer's. So it is sound like that story came from deep within you. Is that something that you've experienced to lead off to your moment of mystery?
You know, my mom has had dementia, so that, you know, it has some personal that. But I also grew up at the Oregon coast and have always found, you know, the phenomenon of severed foot is kind of an interest. And so, and this is book two in the series, so it's a continuation of the characters. So,
well, I think people should pick up one, pick up two, because you know, it's a very engaging writing, and that's what attracts me right away. And storytelling, which should attract anybody. So nice job. Well done. Looking forward to it.
Thank you.
Well, I am sitting with a retired daily newspaper reporter. She spent 10 years doing it. And her new book comes out here in April of this year. And it's hot. It's called Home Fires. So Claire Booth, thank you for coming on doing the noir.
Thank you.
Home Fires. What's kind of the basic premise of this, just so we get an idea?
This is the sixth book in my Sheriff Hank Worth series. He is the sheriff of Branson County, Missouri, which is down in the Ozark Mountains. This particular book starts with a catastrophe and completely out of the blue, and he has to scramble to get an emergency response going in order to take care of this. And so I'm just going to start off with chapter one. Michael Whitaker lay on cream-colored satin and polished oak, a far cry from the cold steel beds he'd used during a 40-year career serving southwestern Missouri's dead. For his own exit, the medical examiner had given himself the priceless gift of not dying suspiciously. Instead, he passed away unexpectedly 2 days after a massive stroke sent him to Springfield Medical Center. So no metal table and floor drain for him. Just an intact corpse and a dignified service with command appearances by law enforcement from more than a dozen counties. Sheriff Hank Worth glanced around the church. No one looked much upset. Whitaker had been an odd duck, staring a little too long, laughing a little too hard, cracking jokes just off-center in their subject matter or timing. You came to his morgue because you needed answers, not because you enjoyed his company. And you came to his funeral because your second-in-command made you. He texted Sheila Truly. "You're missing out. You should have come. Medical leave, remember? You have a wheelchair, so what's the problem?" She shot back with several emojis too caustic to be shared in polite company or read in church. Hank put his phone away as the pastor walked in and stopped to clasp hands with the widow. After a well-honed, mournful pause, he continued to the pulpit placed slightly to the side so the good doctor's casket could sit front and center. Bouquets of lilies lined the front and bullied their way into every nose in the room. The Stone County sheriff next to him shifted uncomfortably in the pew and muttered apologetically about his bursitis. "When'd you see him last?" Hank nodded toward the casket. "About 2 months ago. Motor vehicle accident out near Galena. Two fatalities. How's about you? Had an homicide earlier in the spring, Hank said. I can imagine the chuckles he had with that. Yeah, Hank said. He was always, well, yep, exactly. Two seats down, Webster County's eyes started to water. Ozark County, an affable barrel of a man he'd talked to as they waited outside for the doors to open, was clearly trying to stifle a thunderous series of sneezes. The pastor waded through the lily scent and arrived at his destination. Hank tugged at his uniform sleeve and told himself to pay attention. But the sermon was bland and boring. Say what you would about Whitaker, he at least wasn't either one of those things. The Reverend obviously hadn't known him at all. Hank's mind shifted to the robbery investigation currently on his desk. He tuned back in for a mildly interesting eulogy from a work colleague and stifled a groan as the pastor asked them all to stand and open their hymnals. The church filled with rustling paper and creaking knees as the audience of senior law enforcement officials, mostly old, even more mostly white, definitely mostly men, rose to their feet. Hank sighed and flipped to the right hymn number. The pastor waited a beat and then raised his arms. 50 people took a breath, and Hank's phone went off. It was set on vibrate, but the buzz filled the negative space and seemed to echo off the high ceiling. He shoved the hymnal under his arm and grabbed for it. It kept buzzing. Then Ozarks went off, and Webster County's, and the Springfield police chief. Hank dropped the hymnal altogether as the sounds rolled through the pews in a wave. He read the screen just as Stone County turned to him, his own lit phone clutched in his hand. Oh, my holy God. The fires still burned, and the firefighters stood on the perimeter, watching and weeping. Do we know how many people were inside? Hank asked a man he didn't recognize. No. Command won't let us near it. He nodded toward an SUV off to the right and wiped again at his streaming eyes. My cousin worked. Hank turned away from the blazing crater and walked over to the West County Fire District SUV. What the hell did you do, Sheriff? Bring my entire state with you? The caravan that followed Hank the 35 miles from Springfield was still pulling into the clearing. The vehicle's whirling emergency lights were no match for the pulsating flames that tinted even their blue and red beams a hazy orange. We were at a funeral, Hank said. He looked at the 20-odd squad cars. You can put them to work. Oh, I plan to, Bart Giacalone said. The fire chief stepped onto the SUV's running board and turned to face the group. Y'all grab the fire extinguishers out of your vehicles and start fanning out. Spot fires all over the place. Mop up as many as you can. See something bigger? Give a holler. I'm keeping my guys here in case the main blaze starts to expand, but I'll send one to you if you need. They were gone within seconds and without a word, melting into the woods in the morning heat. Giacalone looked down at Hank. He was a big man, solid but not fat, with buzzed gray hair and a ruddy face that sported a horseshoe mustache bristling all the way around the corners of his mouth and down toward his chin. Right now it was coated with soot and dirt. It's gonna explode again, he said. There's no way that it's not. There are so many damn fireworks in there. Hank nodded. It had been a big warehouse and one of Branson County's more prominent employers until today. He closed his eyes against the heat and the orange and the thought of it all. Any injured? Giacalone shook his head. Nobody that lucky, I'm guessing. He coughed up a ball of smoke-induced phlegm and sent it sailing into the bushes next to his car. You know how many employees they got? Hank said no. The only thing I know is who isn't. The newspaper had a blurb last week about a local kid joining the Marines. The job he quit was at this warehouse. Marines, huh? Giacalone said. Already the smartest decision that kid will ever make. And he ain't even to boot camp yet. I bet his mama's thanking her lucky stars right now. She'd be the only mother in this section of Branson County who was. Hank turned back toward his cruiser and the computer file that laid out the procedure. He was required to call in the state and the feds. And hell, bringing in a few local pastors wouldn't be a bad idea either. He was opening his car door when he heard yelling from across the access site. A woman came running at him, her face so white with fear that the orange glow from the flames didn't darken it at all. The shouts came from his deputy as she tried to chase the woman down. Hank stepped away from the car and directly in front of the woman, wrapping her in a hug. Her momentum staggered him back a few steps before he caught his balance and loosened his hold. She slipped through the line. Deputy March leaned against the cruiser and put her hands on her knees as she caught her breath. She was a decent runner, but the woman was a lot taller and naturally faster. Sorry, sir. They were both close enough now to see the fire, the flattened trees, the stunned firefighters. The woman stopped struggling and sagged into his arms. Ma'am, you can't be here. It is not safe. We're going to take you back to the main road now, Hank said. No, 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 no. It was more a moan than a word. Hank tried to turn her around, but she sank to her knees. The moaning kept on. He knelt in front of her. We're going to get you out of here, and we're going to find you someone to be with you. Now it was a wail. No, 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 no one. Nobody left. Nobody's left. Why didn't he wait? Hank motioned to march, and together they lifted the woman to her feet. Hank walked with them most of the way back to the road. He stopped short when he saw what was there. Dozens more like her, pressing against the caution tape and begging his deputies to let them through. He relinquished his hold on the runner and let Marsh lead her the last little way to the rest of the devastated group. He forced himself to walk away slowly. They didn't need to see an authority figure running from their grief. Once he was out of their sight, he pulled out his phone. Screw the requirement for calling the state and the feds first. He'd start with the clergy, as many of them as he could get. Thank you.
That's amazing. So how do you make it sound so personal? Do you have some experience in that sort of field?
Well, when I was a newspaper reporter, I did cover crime. And so I went out to scenes and spoke with folks who were involved, victims and family members, and, you know, law enforcement, firefighters. And so, you know, I've seen that and the kind of, you know, pain and emotion that is involved for everyone who responds to scenes like that. And it's always important for me to make that as realistic as possible, because, you know, you are talking about, even though they're characters, right, you're talking about a serious event in their lives. And so, making that seem as real as it can is always one of my goals.
Well, you did a great job of it, so thank you. And we look forward to seeing you at Seattle Left Coast Crime.
Oh, me too.
I'm down here with Cindy Goyette, who will be reading from her novel, Obey All Laws, which is about a probation officer, right? And you were a probation officer, so I'll ask you about that after your read.
Yes, that's all true. So I'm going to just read chapter one. I realized I was in trouble when the door bounced open before my feet hit the front steps. What the heck do you want? The man towering in the doorway said. I recognized him as my new client from the mugshot in his file. I tried to disarm him with a smile, but received a death glare back. I'm Casey, your new PO, I said in an upbeat voice. Javier Ramirez was massive, at least 6'4". A grimy tank stretched across his puffed-out chest. Ropes of muscle running down bare arms were no doubt compliments of long hours on a weight bench during his recent stay at the Arizona Department of Corrections. The pitchfork tattoo on his bicep told me he was a member of one of Phoenix's more dangerous gangs. Nice to know. Javier clenched his fists and bounced from one foot to the other. The vein on the side of his bald head pulsated. His eyes were crazy and popping. All signs he was about to go ape.
Oh, my.
My oh crap meter tilted to the warning zone. I probably should have brought another officer or two with me, but I was used to working alone, and his gang involvement wasn't documented in the file I'd received. Look, Javier. I backstepped off the front porch. I just want to schedule an appointment. We can talk in the office tomorrow, okay? I ain't going to no probation office, lady. We can settle this here and now. Where's Hope? Good question. My cousin, Hope Carson, also a probation officer, had mentioned something about a conflict of interest when she gave me the case. She did not say that the conflict might be my desire to live another day and Javier's plans to the contrary. Your case has been transferred to me. I struggled to keep panic from my voice, but I hit a high note that would surely bring a pack of stray dogs my way. He spat on the dusty ground, continuing to flex his hands into fists. She gave it to you. What did you do with it? I had no clue what he was talking about. Do with what? We don't have a phone number for you. I just want to schedule an appointment. Broad shoulders shifted as he moved down the steps. I don't need no appointment. We both know we got bigger problems. Like the fact that he was intent on assaulting me? So far in my career, my verbal de-escalation skills had gotten me out of some tight spots. But my charm was wasted on Javier. I moved my hand to the pepper spray clamped to my belt. Just call me, I tried. We can set up an appointment on the phone. I was backpedaling now, moving across the yard, but he was gaining on me. I pulled out my pepper spray and aimed it at Javier's face. He laughed. He ain't gonna live long enough to use that. I took another step back and pressed the lever. The spray hit him square in the eye. Javier didn't even blink. I should have paid more attention to things like expiration dates. It was time for Plan B, run like hell. I turned to do exactly that when my foot caught on a rock and I fell flat on my butt. The hard dirt, like concrete after months without rain, and sent shockwaves through my body and reverberated in my molars. Heavier was on me before I could say ouch. I tried to hit the panic button on my police radio, but he ripped it out of my hand and tossed it across the yard. Pepper spray dripped off his face onto mine, not expired. The liquid burned my skin, my eyes watered, and it sent me into a coughing fit. Heavier remained unfazed, maybe because he was amped up on meth, or maybe he was just mad enough to overcome the effects, but I had to find another way to stop him. Pulling a gun wasn't an option since I'd opted not to carry one, unlike some of my peers. Now I saw the gaping flaw in my thinking. His hands wrapped around my shoulders before I could contemplate further, and he yanked me to my feet and latched onto my arm. I kicked his shin, but it had no effect as he pulled me toward the house. It was in this moment, the one where my stupidity was staring me in the face, that I usually would have made a deal with the big guy upstairs. Get me out of this and I'd be more careful next time. But the man upstairs and I weren't exactly on speaking terms since my mom died 9 months ago. I couldn't let my family go through another loss so soon. I had to survive this, even if Javier had other ideas. He held on tight and successfully dragged me closer and closer to the house. Fire! I yelled, trying to get the attention of anyone nearby, as I used every ounce of strength I had to pull out of his grip. But it was summer in the desert, and everyone was sealed up in their air-conditioned houses. No one could hear me. Javier shook me like a wet rag. Shut up. My options dwindled. If he got me in the house, it would be a death sentence. I balled up my fist and swung, putting my weight behind it. My hand connected with the side of his head, and something flew out and landed on the ground. What the hell? Javier's free hand shot up and covered his eye. I jerked out of his hold and stumbled back. Something crunched under my running shoe. My eye, Javier cried. You stepped on my eye. I looked down and saw a shattered eyeball under my shoe. Ew! He lunged forward, his empty eye socket zoomed toward my face. I felt for the keys in my pocket, yanked them out, and stabbed my 3-inch-long handcuff key into the gaping hole where Javier's eye used to be. He stood dumbfounded and undoubtedly in a lot of pain. The key stuck into his head like a flagpole in the dirt. My other keys dangled, hitting him in the nose. He growled. Foam sprayed out of his mouth like a rabid dog. Oh, no. Now I'd really made him mad. No way was I winning a fight with this tank of a guy. I did what I should have done from the start. I ran. Heavier's heavy footsteps sounded on the sidewalk behind me. A vehicle approached, and I turned to wave them down, but the dark van didn't slow. It narrowly missed me as I made my way to the other side of the sidewalk. I heard the thump before I saw Javier go airborne and land on his back like a turtle overturned in his shell. The van was a blur as it continued on. Grateful for the help, I didn't bother to get the license plate number. Javier lay still. I wondered if the impact had killed him, but I didn't intend to get close enough to find out. I ran to my Jeep, which I couldn't enter because my keys were stuck in Javier's head. But I felt comfortable with the distance between us. Well, that and the fact that he seemed unconscious. I pulled out my cell phone and dialed 911. Phoenix Police, what's your emergency? This is Casey Carson with Adult Probation. I could use some help. That's it for today.
Wonderful. It was very eye-popping. I couldn't resist. Sorry. Yeah, that was amazing. So tell me a little bit about your experience as a probation officer and how that influences your writing and how this book came to be.
Yeah, well, I was a probation officer in Maricopa County in Arizona for almost 20 years, and I actually had a gang caseload, so the gang thing was familiar to me, so I wanted to tackle that. And Casey was born, and she gets into a lot of trouble after that. That's not even, that's just the beginning.
That's just the beginning?
Yes.
Well, it was great. It was great. Yeah.
Well, it looks like we've got a cozy mystery writer, and her book is Peril in Pink, which comes out in March of this year. So Sydney Lee here's here, and thank you for being here, Sydney.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
This is a story. It's something to do with a B&B, right? So, wow, I'm interested in this.
Yeah, so my book is called Peril in Pink. It's the first in a new series. It's a cozy mystery, so, it's a lighter sort of mystery than what we've heard through some of the some of the stories tonight. So, so I can just start here at chapter one. Pink flamingos make me sick. My brother's easy smile edged towards a disapproving frown. They're a symbol of joy and a cultural icon, not to mention the signature color of the pearl B&B. I cleared my throat. The bird's legs are freakishly spindly, and the namesake cocktail is more Pepto-Bismol pink than our soft blush aesthetic. Nate grabbed the bar towel from his shoulder and started polishing the already clean beer glasses that separated us. Don't you have a B&B to run, Jess? I feigned a pout. Teasing you is much more fun. He finished up the beer glasses and flicked the towel at me. Siblings are supposed to have each other's backs. You're my little brother. It's my job to give you a hard time. Besides, I wasn't insulting your bartending skills, just your choice of drink specials. A voice came out of nowhere. Maybe we should rename it the Nate Byrne Special. Then I drink it every day. I spun around on my bar stool and looked down. Sarah, my brother's new wife, was perfectly balanced on two hands in some twisty yoga position. How long have you been doing that? I asked. She turned her face sideways and looked up at me. I'm working up to 90 seconds. This would be a great one for you to learn. It's good for the detoxification of internal organs. I pressed my lips together. Sarah didn't wear makeup and had a six-pack. I never left home without mascara and preferred rosé to exercise. But she was sweet, if a little too granola-like for my taste. Let me work on the toxify part first and see how far I get. Speaking of toxic, Nate said, Mr. Rock and Roll is here. My stomach knotted. It had been a long time. I resisted the urge to dart around to the other side of the bar and check my hair for fear of ridicule by Nate, who'd never been a fan of my ex. He's not that bad. I hope you were nice to him. I didn't actually see the guy, but a flashy SUV with a personalized plate that reads, Love Me, pulled in while I was passing through the lobby. Okay, might be him. Lars has been known to be a little self-involved. You think? The gas guzzler had all its windows down blasting 80s glam metal. Snort slipped out. No denying it, that was Lars. Leave it to Nate to make my high school boyfriend sound like a complete idiot. Not that he wasn't. Still, I'd never quite rid myself of a soft spot I held for the guy. Plus, he'd won Sing This, Primetime's latest reality songwriting competition 6 months ago. The media referred to him as TV's newest singing sensation. Nate could have given him some props. Bing, bang, boom, babe. Nate sang his best Lars impression. My top lip curled up. Ugh, babe, forgot about that. Nate clapped my shoulder. Don't stress about it, sis. You made it through almost a whole year of dating the creep. What's one more night of listening to a hit song he wrote about you? No way I'd admit a minuscule part of me actually looked forward to seeing him again. Maybe because I didn't really understand it myself. Either way, it was time to face the music maker. I never liked the guy much, but I have to admit, him coming to play an opening night is awesome. Nate was right. I knew the importance of a strong social media presence for a business's success. Being able to splash Lars's photo up on our Instagram feed was huge, especially since it was on brand. The goal was to turn a former boarding house owned and operated by my grandmother back in the 60s and 70s into a chic bed and breakfast. The behemoth Queen Anne-style building was set on a huge swath of land, complete with a big pool, sprawling deck, and adjacent garage-turned bar. Nate and Sarah had recently opened the Cool Vibes Cafe, and it had quickly become a hotspot for locals and tourists alike. Me and my BFF/business partner, Kat Miller, hoped to piggyback on their success with the B&B. Our dream was to make it the trendiest accommodation in the area for bachelorette parties, girls' weekends, date nights, and romantic getaways. Having the winner of a reality TV singing competition come and perform, it definitely got the attention of our target market. My only question was why Lars had agreed to do it. Yes, this was his hometown, but we weren't boasting a large crowd. The B&B had only 10 rooms. The capacity of the bar was well under 100 people. A much smaller number than he'd normally get at a regular performance. He used to play for my grandmother's guests on the back deck with his high school band. Maybe he was feeling nostalgic. Did he miss me? Did he miss home? I caught my reflection as I turned my attention toward the door. I took the opportunity to fluff up my bangs with my fingers and smooth down my long, wavy hair. I knew it. An invisible and judgmental voice said. I whirled around to see my best friend and Pearl co-owner, Kat Miller. She was peering out from behind the collection of faux greenery as if auditioning for a low-budget version of Tarzan. What are you doing back there? I demanded. Didn't we already agree that you weren't allowed to hide from guests? Kat harrumphed as she rose to her full height of 5'10", a fact she lorded over 5'0", me, whenever I was winning an argument. She shook out her shiny jet-black hair as she brushed off her scrawny knees. I was plugging in the espresso maker so it would be ready for when the guests arrived. How about you? Wait, don't tell me. I already know. Checking yourself out before the wannabe rock god gets here. Not her, too. I started to argue, but she cut me off. You are doing that weird, scrunchy eye thing you say for mirror checks. Admit it. You're busted. She folded her arms across her chest and waited for an explanation. Ugh, not fair. I wanted to make the point that she looked good, too. But she always did. Instead, I popped the collar of my dress and held my head high. I'm representing our brand. I can't go around looking like a troll. You're way too delicate and cute to be a troll. Much closer to an elf, in my opinion. And since we're talking opinions, do I need to remind you again to steer clear of Lars? I placed a finger in my ears. What? I can't hear you. There were only so many times I could listen to her rants. He's nothing but trouble. Having him here is a bad idea. Don't get sucked back in. Blah, blah, blah. With Lars's number one hit and a million followers on Insta, her arguments fell flat, and he'd offered to play for free. Besides, I wasn't interested in him anymore. Hot rock stars, so overrated.
Fantastic. So listen, did you have a B&B before? Are you writing from experience?
I didn't have a B&B, but I did run a small business before I started writing. I had a golf range, so I'm familiar with all the regular customers and fun things that go on with running a small business.
And not so fun things.
Yeah, yes.
Well, we appreciate your reading, and we look forward to seeing you at the Seattle Left Coast Crime this year. So thank you.
Thank you. I'm excited to go.
I am happy to be at this end of the bar with the award-winning, critically acclaimed, well-known author, Robert Dugoni, bestseller, variety of books, known for the Tracy Crosswhite series, and I just read Extraordinary Life of Sam Hill, a must-read. Robert will be a featured guest at Left Coast Crime coming up in April when this book will be just right after when this book is released. And so Robert will be reading from A Killing on the Hill, his next book, through April 9th.
Thanks, Joel. The only thing you really need to know about this book is it's 1933 Seattle, and it's based on a true case, true crime. Mrs. Alderbrook shouted as she banged on my door, giving little consideration to either the time, early morning hour or the sleeping schedules of the other occupants of her 12-room boarding house where I rented a room for $5 a month. William! William! You have a telephone call on the house phone! I shot out of bed fearing the worst, a call from my mother that my father had become another depression statistic, like my Uncle Ted. It had been almost a year to the day, June 11th, 1932, that I graduated high school, and my father informed me he could no longer provide me room and board. As moths danced around the bare bulb lighting our porch in Kansas City, Missouri, my father expressed his regret and his frustration. I'm sorry, son. I don't have the money to send you to college, and, well, your Aunt Ida lost Uncle Ted and is coming to live with us. We can't put her out on the street. My Uncle Ted wasn't lost. He'd committed suicide and was buried in Mount St. Mary's Cemetery. It made me nervous knowing my father also hung by a financial and emotional thread. The unemployed don't need an accountant, he told me just before he handed me an armed forces recruitment brochure and asked me, have you thought about the military? I had. Every boy in my high school had given the military thought. William, Mrs. Alderbrook persisted. I can't tie up the line all morning. I'm coming, I shouted and struggled to pull on trousers and make myself presentable. When I yanked the door open, I found the hallway empty of Mrs. Alderbrook's hulking figure and hightailed it down two flights of stairs in my bare feet, fearing she would indeed hang up. She hadn't. The receiver to the upright candlestick telephone lay on the scuffed reception desk. I glanced at the grandfather clock in the lobby, 7:10 a.m. Mrs. Alderbrook glared at me, then lowered her gaze back to the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. Having a reporter for the Seattle Daily Star living in her boarding house didn't influence her choice of newspapers. Politics did. The Post-Intelligencer was the Republican voice, conservative, respectable, and a little prudish. The Seattle Daily Times backed the Democrats and was flashy, bold, and a bit vulgar. Between these two extremes, Howard Fishbaum, the Daily Star owner and my boss, sought to establish a secure foothold publishing the city's only afternoon newspaper. How did he intend to do this? Pizzazz Shoe. Get me pizzazz. Short for Schumacher, Shoe had become my nickname at the newspaper and on the city beat I covered. Don't tie up the line, Mrs. Alderbrook huffed. I placed the receiver to my ear and lifted the speaker to my mouth. My hand quivered. Hello? I said, fearing the worst. William Schumacher. The voice was male. Yes, I said, relieved. No need to shout, son. My hearing is just fine. This is Chief Detective Ernie Blunt. After a year hustling stories, from the mayor's recall for graft and corruption and his reelection just 6 weeks late, 6 months later, I'd finally received my hard-earned press badge from the chief of police. The badge accorded me access to crime scenes, though I had yet to be contacted by a detective, and certainly not one as esteemed as Ernie Blunt, the chief detective of Seattle's famed homicide squad. I moved the speaker away from my mouth. Yes, chief detective. I've just received a call to hurry to the Pom Pom Club. Might be a gangster shooting. You know it. My adrenaline spiked. A gangster shooting. Pizzazz. If you want the story, meet me there in 15 minutes. Top of Profanity Hill at 10th and Yesler. Can't miss it. Big white house. Profanity Hill, 10th and Yesler. A gangster shooting, you said. Yes. Try not holding the speaker so close to your mouth, Blunt said. I'm liable to go deaf. I moved the speaker away another few inches. I'll find it, I said. The perch clicked. Mrs. Alderbrook's meaty hand had reached the counter and ended my call. I raced up the stairs to my room. In no time, I had finished dressing, grabbed my jacket and knit cap, and stocked my leather satchel with pencils and notebook paper before slinging it over my shoulder and hurrying back downstairs. I handed Mrs. Alderbrook the key to my room, which she kept on a hook below my mail slot, then rushed out the door to catch the 2nd Avenue streetcar at Pike Street for the 10-block ride south to Yesler Way. At Yesler, I transferred to the streetcar that took me up Profanity Hill. My timing was impeccable and fortuitous. I didn't want to walk up First Hill. The city courthouse had once loomed large atop the hill, and stories were told of red-faced lawyers, judges, and litigants lugging heavy briefcases and uttering profanities when the streetcar broke down, which was often, giving First Hill its nickname. I arrived at 10th Avenue in just 12 minutes. The silence that precedes dawn still hung heavily over Profanity Hill. The White House did indeed stand out, as Blunt had said it would, but not as I had imagined. Blunt's use of the term gangster killing had caused me to imagine a back alley dive rather than the elegant two-story home I encountered. The house was nearly a quarter of a block long. Its fresh coat of paint, expansive sloping lawn, and ornate flower beds were both a sharp contrast to the homes around it and an indication money flowed freely within the club's walls. It had no doubt been one of the many mansions the wealthy built atop the 366-foot slope. First Hill was peppered with Georgian revivals and Italianate and Queen Anne Victorians with slate roofs, gabled bays, teakwood furnishings, mosaic tile floors, oriental carpets, stained glass windows, and half a dozen fireplaces. As business and industry had expanded and the necessary waterfront workforce moved to First Hill, the wealthy, loath to mix, fled. Their mansions had become low-rent boarding houses, hotels, and disorderly houses of prostitution. I noted a patrol car parked at the curb and a Cadillac just around the corner from the club's front entrance. My nerves tingled with anticipation as I approached a police officer in his navy blue uniform and peaked hat standing in front of a heavy-looking entrance door. The door was one of two. The second, an interior door, had a grated peephole I had seen in Chinatown speakeasies. Club members either showed a pass or uttered a password. And if the police came by the establishment, the person manning the interior door flipped a switch to flicker the lights, a sign to the staff to hide alcohol and evidence of gambling. Getting closer, I recognized the officer's grim expression and large form. Officer Lutz, I said, adjusting the press badge on my lapel. Lutz was a stout man of German descent, which seemed to give us common ground, though I was just 5'9" and 140 pounds. Shoo! How did you get here so fast? Lutz asked, his gravelly voice from the early morning hour. Lutz was close to retirement. His gray hair had receded in a horseshoe pattern, and his blue eyes had become clouded with age, like my Oma's. Got a call of a shooting, I said, having learned from Fish, which is what everyone called Howard Fishbaum, to never reveal a source. We beat reporters had an unwritten agreement with the police department, especially the brass. The police provided us with story tips and access to crime scenes, police investigations, witnesses, and ultimately, the prosecutor who would try the case. In return, we wrote favorable articles about the police department. Step out of line, and the chief of police would pull your press badge. The relationship was incestuous, even to me, just a year on the job. But in a depression, most people were a paycheck away from moving to one of the city's Hoovervilles, shanty towns named after the former president, to house Seattle's homeless and down and out. Hmm, Lutz grunted. Well, you can't go in, not yet, waiting on the detectives. You been in, I asked. Found the body, he said. Called it in. What time was that? Call came in at 6:30 this morning. I got here as quick as I could. How many shots were fired? Can't be certain. Anyone inside when you arrived? Another nod. George Miller, the owner, and his partner, Sid Broom. A waiter, and the bartender, too. Also the caretaker who cleans the place was asleep in the back. Who got shot? Frankie Ray. The prize fighter? Let's eyes narrowed. Before your time, ain't he?
That's great. I love historical fiction, so I'm just going to gobble this up. But I want to ask this question. Since you're regarded as a master storyteller, why don't you tell us where this story came from, this historical story came from?
Yeah, it's really a great story. I was up in the attic cleaning things out and found a 14 by 17 inch book, opened it up, and it was a scrapbook, and it had all these articles in it. And it had particularly probably more than 100 articles about what was called the trial of the century, which was the gangster killing of Frankie Ray, a lightweight boxer in the Pom Pom nightclub on Profanity Hill, by a guy by the name of George Miller, who ran the club, which was being run during the Great Depression. And so, you know, everything that was going on there was basically illegal. A lot of booze was passing through their gambling, prostitutes, et cetera. And there was also larger magazine articles that came out after the trial that ends up happening. And so I asked my wife, you know, where did these scrapbooks come from? And they were her grandfather. And this was one of his cases. And it's a fascinating story about Seattle in 1933, which really was a place of incredible corruption. From the shoeshine boys who were taking 25 cents to shine your shoes and they would find you a girl to spend the night with, to the mayor, who was taking kickbacks from anybody and everybody, and the chief of police knew about it, and everybody sort of turned a blind eye because it was the Depression, and everyone was trying to make a living. So in the middle of all this comes this very naive young reporter who's trying to make a name for himself and trying to make some money. He's sending money home to his family when he can to try to keep them afloat. And I fictionalized the reporter to tell the story. And he gets in bed with this detective and pretty soon begins to realize that the story is a lot bigger than he ever imagined.
Well, the truth makes a good foundation for a great fiction story. And I think we heard 8 minutes of a great fiction story. Looking forward to it coming out. I'll get one autographed at Left Coast Crime. Hopefully I'll see you there.
My good friend Robin Geigel, who will be reading from her new novel, Nothing But the Truth, which is out in June, and I'm super excited to hear from it. Robin, take it away.
Thank you, John. It's good to see you. So this is Chapter 2 of Nothing But the Truth, and it's Chapter 1, not giving anything away. Chapter 1 is a murder. Chapter 2 is when we meet the main protagonist, Aaron McCabe. November 20th, 2009. The candles on the altar flickered, throwing strange shadows across the enormous stained glass windows that rose up to the vaulted ceiling of the chapel. Aaron McCabe stood among a group of people she had come to know over the last 5 years. Their journeys were very different, but they were compatriots nonetheless, joined by a common thread. a thread that also knitted them to the names being solemnly read to the 50 or so people gathered in the pews. From the United States, Caprice Curry, age 31. Foxy Ivy, age 25. Paula Ibera, age 24. As each name was read, it was displayed on a large screen. Each name a life lost, most of them young, most women of color, all of them killed in the last 12 months because they were transgender, non-binary, or gender non-conforming. Tears rolled from the corner of Erin's eyes. This was her third year attending the Transgender Day of Remembrance at the Princeton Chapel, and each year was harder than the previous, the list of names growing longer every year. Tonight, she and her companions took turns reading each of the 163 names of the people lost. Once they slid out of the pew, Erin gave Logan Stevens a hug. Logan, a self-described biracial, pansexual, genderqueer attorney, had played a huge role in Erin's last case. Gathering their belongings, they made their way out into the unseasonably warm evening. A few of us are heading over to the Alchemist and Barrister to grab something to eat. You want to join us? Logan asked. Sure, Erin replied. Excuse me, a man called out as he approached. Would you be Erin McCabe? I am, Erin replied. I don't mean to be rude, but are you the criminal defense lawyer? He asked skeptically. Yeah, I'm not Erin McCabe, she responded with a small grin. And to answer your next question, as far as I know, I'm the only Erin McCabe who's a criminal defense attorney in New Jersey. I'm sorry, the man stammered. I apologize. You just look too young to be the infamous Erin McCabe criminal defense lawyer, Logan suggested with a chuckle. Erin tried not to blush, but at 5'5", with a dusting of freckles across the bridge of her nose and a slim athletic figure, she was still blessed with a youthful appearance that belied the fact that she was a seasoned attorney with a unique backstory. Is there something I can help you with? Erin asked. The man rubbed the back of his neck, appearing uncertain. Is it possible for us to speak privately? I only need a couple minutes. It's about a potential case. Erin studied the man. He appeared to be in his early 30s and was significantly taller than her, so she guessed that he was close to 6 foot. He was a good-looking guy, well-built. He was wearing a black suit with a white shirt that was unbuttoned at the collar, exposing a gold crucifix hanging from a chain around his neck. And even though Erin didn't sense any danger, she felt better with Logan standing next to her. Is it about representing you? Erin asked. No, not me. I have a friend who needs help. That's fine, but just so you know, if it's not about representing you, the attorney-client privilege doesn't apply. Okay, he finally said. I guess I don't have a choice, but can we speak alone? Please, don't take this the wrong way, but I prefer to have Logan here. Logan's also an attorney, and we sometimes work together, so anything you want to say to me, you should feel free to discuss with them here as well. Them? The man repeated, looking around. Yeah, Logan's genderqueer and uses they-them theirs pronouns. Oh, he replied, unable to mask his confusion. I apologize. I don't know your name, Erin said. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't introduce myself. I'm Gabriel. Gabriel DeAngelis. Please call me Gabe, he replied, offering his hand to Erin and Logan in turn. How can I help you, Gabe? Erin asked. DeAngelis seemed to glance around as if anyone was within earshot. Like I said, it's not for me. It's for my friend. He was arrested 2 days ago. He's charged with murder, and he desperately needs an attorney, and you come highly recommended. Nice to know someone highly recommends me, Erin said. What's your friend's name, and who's he charged with murdering? My friend is John Mazur, and he's charged with murdering Russell Marshall, Erin said, finishing the sentence. DeAngelis took a deep breath. I guess you saw it on the news? Gabe, unless I was living in a cave on Borneo, it would be pretty hard for me not to know about the case. A white state trooper shoots a black newspaper reporter in the reporter's home, a reporter who allegedly was working on an expose of the state police. I mean, the governor, state attorney general, and the superintendent of the state police have all condemned your friend as a bad apple in an otherwise stellar law enforcement agency. They're full of it, Gabe shouted. I won't argue with you about that, Erin said, but from what I read, it still sounds like the state has a pretty solid case. That's exactly why John needs you. He didn't do it. He was the one working with Marshall to expose the corruption within the state police. Look, Gabe, Let me be blunt. I presume you know that I'm a transgender woman. And generally speaking, law enforcement doesn't have a great reputation within the LGBTQ plus community. On top of that, my law partner, Dwayne Swisher, is a black man. I'm sure I don't have to tell you how sick and tired black people are of being killed by white law enforcement officers. Ms. McKay, please call me Aaron. Aaron, I get it, but not John's not just any trooper. He's gay. He's the only out gay male trooper we're aware of. And since he was avid, other troopers have put him through hell. They literally hate him. He bit down at his lip, closed his eyes, and exhaled. John's a close friend. Trust me, he didn't do it. You have to help him. Not to be crass, Gabe, but does he have money to pay for a lawyer? We'll find a way. Aaron reached into her purse and took out a business card and handed it to DeAngelis. Let me talk to my partner. Do you have a card? He reached into his pocket, took out a card, quickly jotted something on the back, and handed it to her. She looked at the card, then at him. That's interesting. Please don't call me at work, he said. I wrote my cell number on the back. Can you call me around 10 on Monday, she asked. Yeah, 10 will work. Okay, I'll talk to you then. He turned and headed down the walkway towards Nassau Street. Once he was out of sight, they made their way to join the others at the restaurant. You going to take the case, Logan asked. Aaron shrugged. Don't know. At this point, I don't even know if he can afford an attorney. Not to mention, I'm not sure how Dwayne will feel about the racial overtones of the case. I guess we'll see. How about the fact that based on what's been in the press, his friend is guilty of sin, Logan asked. Nah, that's not a consideration. If Dwayne and I only took on clients who were innocent, we've been out of business years ago. Logan laughed. You think Gabe and Mazur are more than friends? Don't know, Aaron said. But it would explain Gabe's desire for confidentiality. Why? Logan asked. Aaron handed Gabe's card to Logan. Logan looked down at the card, stopped in their tracks, and screamed, What the? Are you kidding me? Reverend Gabriel DeAngelis St. Raymond's Roman Catholic Church? You can't make this stuff up, Aaron said. Damn, woman, Logan said. You sure do get some crazy cases. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin. That was terrific. I'm absolutely hooked. I can't believe I have to wait until June for it. So I'm curious. So you're tackling, in this case, a racially motivated crime. Why did you choose the subject matter? And clearly you're approaching it from lots of different complex angles. But I'm just fascinated. How did you land on this idea?
I do a lot of diversity, equity, and inclusion work. The issues surrounding, the LGBTQ plus community, racial diversity, all those issues really interest me. I have two main characters, one who's transgender, the other who's a black man. And again, in New Jersey, the state police do have a reputation for racial profiling. There have been court cases and consent orders, and even as recently as a few months ago, again, racial profiling by the New Jersey State Police. And the group within the state police that I talk about in the novel allegedly really exists. They were a rogue group of troopers that were known as the Lords of Discipline, and they did racially profile lots of motorists on New Jersey highways. So it's based on some real facts, and it just held a lot of interest for me in terms of bringing a lot of different types of issues to the fore, so to speak.
Oh, it sounds riveting. I can't wait. It's nothing but the truth.
This has been a production of the House of Mystery Radio Show. To find out more about our show, guests, or hosts, go to our website at houseofmysteryradio.com.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery Radio Show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, all shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.